what entitles us to believe that Christian faith is the exclusive means to truth?
It's a great question, and I think it would probably rank in the top 5 or 6 or 7 questions that you need to ask, and thank you for asking it. There are basically, contrary to what people might think, there are not that many, there's not an infinite number of answers to the question that you have raised. There's the Judeo-Christian worldview, there's the Islamic worldview, there are the pantheistic worldviews, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and all of many of the other isms that are takeoffs on that, that have a pantheistic backdrop to it, where every life is a rebirth and the karmic law is at work. And so whether you take Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, whatever, they believe in at least 2 things that they all hold on to, that every birth is a rebirth and every birth is a payment for your previous life. So the karmic law and the reincarnation law hold true in most of the pantheistic frameworks. You've got 2 very contrary views in the monotheistic worldview, the Judeo-Christian worldview on one side of it and the Islamic worldview on the other. We often think all religions are fundamentally the same and only superficially different. It's actually the opposite is true. They are fundamentally different and at best only superficially similar. Even the golden rule is not the same in Confucianism as it is in the words of Jesus Christ. So while your question is the most important one, the Judeo-Christian worldview, I think, has the answer for what you are asking. Your worldview is a set of lenses through which you look at reality. Whether you think about it or not, you're always looking through those lenses. And that worldview has been framed by answering 4 questions. The question of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. 4 questions: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. What are you looking for? The one question you're looking for is the answer to the truth. What is the truth? How do you come to the truth? Philosophy will tell you there's the correspondence theory and the coherence theory. Statements you make about specific answers have to correspond to reality, and when all of those answers are put together, there has to be a coherence to these answers. If there's a systemic contradiction, you will pick it up immediately. Looking for truth, correspondence, coherence. How do we arrive at it? Logical consistency, empirical adequacy, experiential relevance. That's the way the classic points of testing have gone. Logically consistent, empirically adequate, and experientially relevant. Truth, correspondence, coherence, logical consistency, empirical adequacy, experiential relevance. Origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. You take the 1, 2, 3, 4 grid, and you will generally find, as a rule, the responses made coming from 1 of 5 disciplines. Either from theology, or you're dealing with epistemology, you're dealing with cosmology. There are 5 major disciplines that converge into the answers that are raised in origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. Why is it that Jesus Christ is so exclusive and unique? And in talking about the scriptures to the gentleman who asked that fine question earlier, right in the time of Jesus, in the very time of Jesus, the entire gospel was captured in 1 hymn. It is the earliest complete gospel we have. Interestingly enough, in a hymn that they sang, Paul repeats it, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, made himself of no reputation, took upon himself the form of a servant, being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also has exalted him and given to him a name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. That was the earliest fragment they found. That's why the Bible talks about how they sang to each other in spiritual songs. Now that gospel meta-narrative is so unique because you go back across the Old Testament, you've got the 40 plus books, total books, 66 books with 40 different authors. They all point towards the following reality, that the problem with humanity is not outside of ourselves. The problem with humanity is inside of ourselves. Your heart and my heart is desperately wicked. We don't like the word sin. And so when I'm interviewed, if you on a media, if you want to end the interview and they say, what's the problem then? And if you say sin, the interview is over. So I don't say that. I say the problem is we have lost the purpose for which we were created. And they look at you and say, what was that purpose? And that's when you realize that the purpose that God has created for you and me is that relationship with Him, that communion with Him. And when He says the greatest commandment out of 613 laws given, when Jesus was asked what is the greatest commandment, He said that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and all your mind and all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. On these two laws says hang all of the prophets and all the commandments. These two laws, to love God and love your fellow human being. You do not get that imperative and that intrinsic worth from any other worldview. That you are made imago Dei. You are made in the image of God. I have no way and justification by which I can violate you. So your intrinsic worth, your departure from purpose, what is the remedy? The remedy is when grace and truth, I am a creature in need of forgiveness. You are a creature in need of forgiveness. And when Jesus looks at his murderers and says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. What you're really finding out is that the four absolutes we look for, evil, justice, love, and forgiveness, are answered in the life, death, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So he diagnoses your malady, gives to you the way of the cure, builds into your life that proclivity for following him and embracing his truth, and enables you to love your neighbor as yourself, even in the disagreements with which we live. So I say to you, you ask any other worldview, or take even the American Declaration of Independence, that we hold these truths to be self-evident. What is that? Self-evident. And that we have been endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Pantheism would never have said that. Naturalism would never have said that. And dare I suggest, even the Islamic worldview wouldn't say that, because we are not created equal in that worldview. There are two houses, the house of war, the house of Islam. As far as I'm concerned, even people who I disagree with, my Lord has told me to love them and to be willing even to lay down my life for the truth that He's given to us. The answers of Jesus are so beautiful and so unique. That's why the hymn writer says, heaven above is softer blue, earth around is sweeter green. Something lives in every hue Christless eyes have never seen. Birds with gladder songs o'erflow, stars with deeper beauty shine. Since I know as now I know, I am His and He is mine. And I leave you with just two footnotes, one from a child and one from a philosopher. My grandson Jude is just turned 6. When he was about 3.5 years old, his mother Naomi, my daughter, lost her car keys. And she was looking around the house and slapped her forehead and said, I must be losing my mind. This little guy comes and stands in front of her and says, Mommy, whatever you do, please don't ever lose your heart because I'm in there. Don't ever lose your heart because I'm in there. The Bible says, out of the mouths of infants and babes He has ordained praise. Who taught this little boy the security and the sanctity of love? When I was doing philosophy in the 80s, the famous philosopher we had to study was Anthony Flew. We had to find responses to Flew. We studied Flew, and one of my colleagues, Michael Ramsden, even met up with Anthony Flew. But before Anthony Flew died, he made this comment, and much more than this. He said, if I can be convinced that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and he talked about the writings of N.T. Wright, the famed writer who's written about the resurrection, and corresponded extensively with Gary Habermas, the historian, debated and dialogued, he said, it all hinges for me on this, if Jesus really rose again from the dead. And if that resurrection story is true, he said, I would be willing to be convinced, because C.S. Lewis convinced him of the moral framework, and now he was waiting for the empirical evidence of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. No other worldview will give you correspondingly true and coherent answers to the questions of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny, your intrinsic worth and your neighbor's intrinsic worth. One Islamic scholar in Damascus, Sheikh Hussein, he and I dialogued for several hours in front of an audience. He was a very respectful man. Kept referring to me for some reason as Professor, Professor Zacharias, Professor Zacharias. In the end, when we finished and had to make our closing statement, he looked at me and he said this in front of an audience. He said, Professor Zacharias, maybe it's about time for us in the Islamic worldview. This is a Shiite cleric, the leading Shiite cleric in Syria. He said, Professor Zacharias, maybe it's about time for us in the Islamic world to stop asking if Jesus died on the cross and to ask why. I said, Sheikh Hussein, do I have your permission to quote you on that? He said, yes, you do. I said, thank you. The birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, prophesied, predicted, exactly fulfilled. He gives you answers that no other worldview does. That's why it's fundamentally different and at best only superficially similar. I urge you to take the Gospel of John and read it, and you will see the answers to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Let's leave aside Christianity and historical examples for a second. All night you guys have been grappling with issues like morality and, you know, what is right, what is wrong, and meaning. But my question is simply, why are you so afraid of subjective moral reasoning? I mean, do you think that we're all just going to start raping and pillaging just because we don't have a book to tell us what to do? I mean, are you afraid of that? Like, I'm not, because that's not going to happen. And that, yeah, Nazis were bad, but there were Christian Nazis and there were atheist Nazis. So I don't see, what are you so afraid of?
Do you lock your door at night?
Yeah. Sure.
You know, I hear what you're saying. Sounds very cavalier, though. My goodness, if we weren't afraid of all of this, we would not be in a national debt. The billions.
China is secular.
Sorry?
China is secular.
Sorry?
China is secular.
That's right. What does that mean?
I mean, they're not raping and pillaging, and neither are we.
Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my. Oh my. Have you read what happened during the Red Guards Rebellion? Have you read what happened during the Boxer Rebellion? Do you know who has killed more people in the 20th century than China and Russia? 60 million apiece? Wow. It makes the Holocaust seem tame. The 20th century became the bloodiest century in history. And the reason it became the bloodiest century in history, I can see, is you could just see the weapons of our warfare were piling up and there was no guiding principle to take us anywhere. Now, in a perfect world, yes, we don't need to be afraid. Have you seen what happens in our courts of law where people supposedly love each other and all that comes about in hate and vitriol and damage? I don't think the question is fairly stated as what are you afraid of. I'm just saying it is basically unlivable. I didn't conclude that. An atheist like Jean-Paul Sartre concluded it. We killed more people in the 20th century than the previous 19 put together. And your question is, what are we afraid of? The fact of the matter is, if morality is purely subjective, then you have absolutely nothing from stopping anybody for being a subjective moralist to choose to just zing one through your forehead and say, that's my answer. You know, how do you stop that? Obviously, you don't believe that's the way it should be. No, neither do I. So it's not a case of what am I afraid of. It's a case of the fact that if you're willing to say to me that moral reasoning can be purely subjective, I just say to you, look out, you ain't seen nothing yet if everybody believed what you did. Do you know, funny, interesting, when I was in the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, Stalin eliminated 15 million of his own people. 15 million of his own people. And at the center for geopolitical strategy, you know, they didn't want to even name his name and so on. His daughter, Svetlana, made the comment, it is quoted both by Malcolm Muggeridge in his writings and by historian Paul Johnson in Modern Times. Svetlana was standing by the bedside of her father before he died. She said the last thing he did was clench his fist over the heavens one more time, put his head back on the pillow, and he was gone. This is his daughter raising the question, whatever got into my father to have that kind of hatred and hostility? And when 15 million were killed of his own people, it is interesting that the faculty members and the general who chatted with me there, my wife will tell you, sat around the table with tears in his eyes when he watched what had been done to his own country by his own leadership. So subjective morality would be very good if we all wanted to be nice people and live around each other without any fear of each other. But the reason you lock your doors, and the reason we have our police, and the reason we have our military, and the reason we have our law courts, is because when subjective morality becomes totally subjectivized, this is what happens in society. So it's a great idea, but I hope nobody absorbs it. Thank you. We go on to the next one there. Thank you.
For you is that through my cursory review of most religions, it seems like they all have a common thread of answering the question which seems to plague us all, which is what happens to us when we die. It's the one question I think that a lot of us have difficulty with because we cannot answer it. And so it seems like this common thread is it gives us hope for the afterlife, something better than what we have right now. And it feels like, I feel like a lot of religions that what they do is they put forth codes or rules of conduct to help us live a good life so that we can achieve this afterlife. And so given this commonality, what makes you believe that Christianity is the correct or right religion?
Great question. And your name is?
Suketu.
Spell that for me.
S-U-K-E-T-U.
Suketu. I think you've asked a very, very important question. First of all, let me qualify it a little bit, and I'm sure you already know that not all religions talk about an afterlife. Mainly the monotheistic ones do. The pantheistic ones are reincarnation. Even the reincarnation between Buddhism and Hinduism is a little different. In Hinduism, it's the transference of identity one into another in a different form. But in Buddhism, it's not even sure whether it's the identity that's transmigrated or just another form of essence that has emerged. A worldview is built not on one line of argument. A worldview is built on a connected series of arguments. And if a worldview were just built on one line of argument, I think this is the mistake naturalism often makes. It'll take sort of one argument that it has in its favor and forget all the myriad other questions that emerge. When I look at the person and the work of Jesus Christ, this is the most important question I had to ask. Now, granted, I asked it in reverse fashion because I was on a bed of suicide, a Bible was brought to me, and I prayed a prayer of desperation. I grant you that. I just had no hope. But I was read the verse, Jesus said, because I live, you also shall live. I just said, this is talking about a life that I don't have. And maybe this is the life I need. And so I prayed that prayer. But then I made a prayer commitment right on that bed. I was 17 and I said, Jesus, if you're who you claim to be, I will leave no stone unturned in my pursuit of truth. Because my goal was truth. Pragmatically, it made sense for me to hang on to a life jacket that was thrown my way. But then I began my years and years and years of study. When you look at the life of Christ from the prophetic schema of hundreds of years before, where he was going to be born, what he was going to do, what his name was going to be called, how the manner of birth was, the manner of life he was going to lead, how he was going to die, and then the resurrection from the dead. The uniqueness about the New Testament and Old Testament scriptures, it's not a single author, it's multiple authors. As you know, 66 books, 40 different authors have edited it, and it is interesting that Paul, Saul of Tarsus, who wrote one third of it, came in a reverse fashion to the rest of them. The disciples came birth, life, death, resurrection, and that's how they found new Jesus. Not so with Saul, who became Paul. He said when he was encountered the risen Christ, he said that I may know him, the power of the resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering, being made conformable unto his death. He started with the resurrection, but he said he needed to understand the cross because he came in reverse chronological order, but he encountered the risen Christ. The conversion of Saul of Tarsus and Thomas, especially these two dramatic conversions, are powerful witnesses of what happened. Saul, who was killing them, he was standing there watching Stephen being martyred and kept the clothes of those who were stoning him. Thomas, who said, I'm not going to believe until I see the resurrected Christ myself. And he went to India, where there are 330 million deities. And he went and preached the gospel of Jesus and paid with his own life. That kind of dramatic transformation took place not because of just one event, but a connected series of events. So, here's the bottom line. A worldview is built around four questions: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. Origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And there are three tests for truth: logical consistency, empirical adequacy, and experiential relevance. Logical consistency, empirical adequacy, and experiential relevance. Three tests for four questions. And when you take the prophecy of Christ hundreds of years before, from his virgin birth, you take the purity of his life, unmatched, totally unmatched till this very day. Then the death that he promised for the forgiveness of sins, and then the resurrection. As an Easterner, I asked myself this question. When Jesus was asked how he was going to demonstrate it, if he were a fake, he would have said, I'm going to spiritually rise again. And they would never be able to falsify it. But he said, I'm bodily going to rise again. That is an empirically falsifiable dictum. All they would have had to show him was the body and say, where is he? You said he was going to rise again. So it's in the whole schema of the prophetic corpus, the hundreds of years, the multiple authors pointing towards the same person, from his virgin birth to the purity of his life to the death on the cross for forgiveness when he said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they are doing. And then the resurrection again. My four questions are answered correspondingly with truth on specific questions and coherently when all of the questions are put together and answers are given. So to me, first of all religions are not the same. They are actually, people say they're fundamentally the same, superficially different. Actually, they're fundamentally different and at best superficially similar. And the fundamental difference that you see in Jesus Christ is in his uniqueness and exclusivity of his claim and the embrace that he gives to all humanity, the perfection of his life, the purity of his life, the death and the resurrection. To me, that coherence of his answers convinces me that he is who he claimed to be. And truth, by definition, is exclusive. All truth claims to be exclusive. Buddhism claims to be exclusive. Hinduism claims to be exclusive. They all have exclusivity built into that. But in the person of Christ, you see the demonstration in his birth, life, death, and resurrection. So I say to me, I am convinced that because it coheres and because I have personally verified it in my own life, and you can do that too and find that experience and that he is who he claimed to be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask the next one from Twitter.
Just to add something that Ravi's already mentioned, but the resurrection was particularly key for me in my investigation of this. I was studying philosophy. It was very important to me not to have to take some blind leap of faith. And the fact that there was a publicly verifiable historical claim that I could look into was very, very important. And if you asked scholars 100 years ago, how did we come up with a Christian myth of the resurrection? They would have said, well, one person told the truth to this person, that person told this person, that person told this person, and a few generations down the line, we had a crazy myth of the resurrection. Since then, in the last couple of decades, scholarship has really turned around on this question, in part because there are a few places in the Bible, in particular a passage at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 15. Maybe you can have a look at it later, but it's a very early creed, and it lists all of the people and the groups that Jesus appeared to. He appeared to individuals and to groups at different times, in different places, doing many different things. And today, even the most atheistic critical scholars date that passage, that early creed, to almost immediately after Jesus' actual death and supposed resurrection. So the legendary development hypothesis has been thrown out of the window. What people know now is that there actually were a lot of people. The passage says hundreds of people, and then it says most of whom are still living, almost as if to say, go out and ask them yourself. There were many people who were utterly convinced they had seen this man, Jesus, alive and interacting with him after he had died. And so that then raises the question, what can account for that? What can account for this huge historical gap between what should have been the movement-ending death of Jesus and then the explosion of Christianity?
Jews worshiping a man as God, unthinkable. The Sabbath changed from Saturday to Sunday, unthinkable. What bridges the gap which is there no matter what you believe? That's the question for anyone. Christians bridge that gap with the resurrection. When I was looking into this as a university student, I asked the top two skeptical New Testament scholars at Princeton to meet up for a coffee to talk about this, because I said, this is what I've just laid out for you. This is what I'm seeing. Here's the big gap. And I thought, okay, Christians fill that gap with the resurrection, but surely those who aren't Christians must have equally plausible alternatives. And I said to them, how do you fill that gap? And one of them glanced towards a mass hallucination hypothesis, which isn't taken seriously in the literature. She wasn't glancing towards it with any conviction either. There's simply too much data, too many appearances, too many people. Hallucinations are things that happen to individuals, not to groups. The other one, who was a historian, simply said, I'm not interested in that question as a historian. There was some sort of assumption that because it was a miraculous claim, it was therefore not within the remit of proper history, and I've never understood why. So for me, the resurrection, the fact that you could have arguments that you can consider for that, was that blew my mind. I just assumed that's an ancient claim that we could just never know whether that happened or not. But actually, you can look into it, and you can look at the facts, and then you can ask the question, what best explains the facts? And the reality is that today in the scholarship, the only explanation which is given any degree of credibility is the fact that Jesus actually rose from the dead. Every other explanation has been completely undermined, and so I think it is a rational decision to say that actually happened, and then to take that next personal step of praying a prayer like the one that I prayed, which was, God, the Christian God, I don't know if I'm talking to anyone, but if I am, I'd